Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Healthcare professionals, educators, and Governor Noem have all said that the safe and effective reopening of schools in South Dakota is critical, even during the COVID-19 pandemic. When many children and families are experiencing economic hardship and social isolation, schools can have a profoundly positive impact on the health, well-being, and development of students. But it's not enough to want to go back to school. We need to understand the emerging science of kids and teens and COVID-19 in order to make smart decisions this school year. For insight, we welcomed Sanford Health's Dr. Wendell Hoffman to talk about SARS-CoV-2 transmission and back to school. Dr. Wendell Hoffman, thanks for being here.
Thanks very much, Lori. Good to be with you.
I just want to turn it over to you for a minute and ask the first question, which is, you know, what kind of science is emerging about kids and teenagers and SARS-CoV transmission? Like, what do we know at this point? What do we not know?
Great question. We probably could use a couple of hours to roll through this, but yeah. What do we know? What we know, and this was early on in the pandemic data coming out of China, is that we knew early on from their experience that this virus was very mild in terms of its effect on children. That data continued to be the case going forward as we have been engulfed in our own pandemic here in the U.S. So kids and youth count for, in multiple studies, maybe 5 to 10% of the overall SARS-CoV-2 symptomatic infections. In South Dakota, I believe I calculated that about 12% of the total number of positive cases. Remember, these are positive cases, so they do not count asymptomatic cases. And if it is true that the total number of infections may be, 8 to 10 times the number of positives, then of course we have many more that we don't even know about. But the point being is that the children and youth count for a small percentage overall. There is some data, particularly now with the now famous South Korea study, to suggest that children, particularly those under 10, may be less susceptible to SARS-CoV-2 infection and potentially less likely to transmit the virus to others. Also, there's, I think, strong evidence, and I always have to qualify this because I do depend heavily on my pediatric colleagues, and I don't pretend to be a pediatrician, nor have I ever played one on TV, but I have seen a lot of kids in my career, and I do have great admiration and also also for the guidance that my pediatric infectious disease colleagues have struggled with, and pediatricians in general have struggled with trying to put together these recommendations. That said, there's strong evidence that the majority of children and youth who become infected are either asymptomatic or only have mild symptoms such as cough, fever, and sore throat. So I think we have to put all of this into that background context. To say, for instance, of the 1,136 hospitalizations in the 0 to 19 category in South Dakota, I believe there have only been 25 hospitalizations. That's a 2.2% hospitalization rate. It's very small. We have zero deaths in that group. And so I think the emerging science says that the young children may be a little bit different as you get older. Now, as you turn age 10 and you move up into middle school and high school, you begin to look more like the adult patient in terms of the ability to transmit it to each other and to others, say, in the family. So I think that's an accurate summary of the emerging science as we have it with regards to transmission and seriousness of disease.
Can you speak a little more to whether or not kids can bring the virus home to their families if they're asymptomatic or if they're mildly symptomatic? What do we know about how likely they are to transmit it to adults?
So Yes. I mean, I think we can say that. And remember, we stopped the school closures kind of right earlier on in the pandemic in the United States. So there's a lot we have to learn. However, the data worldwide suggests that kids are probably more likely to get it within their households than they are in non-households. But we really don't know because we've not entered our own experiment, if you will, in this country. We are comparing ourselves to other countries, and while that's very, very good, I think we have to say that we can expect that there will be more infections as the schools open up. I mean, all you need to do is look at the kids out in the at the camp in the Black Hills. When you get kids together, there's going to be transmission. That's why all these mitigating strategies are so important. So I think we have to be honest and say we can expect probably that we may well have more cases. Now, the average age of a teacher in South Dakota, I actually looked this up, was about, I think it was 42.7, 43-ish. Now, so if the average age is in that range, we have to say that the vast majority of teachers, for instance, and probably parents, are going to be in that age group where they're, if they do come down with COVID-19, they also are going to experience a relatively mild condition. So I think the overall risk, we may have a lot of cases, but I think we need to focus on the sort of seriousness and therefore. Hopefully respect the virus, but not fear it.
Yeah. Let's talk about mitigation strategies. You said they're so important. So for many parents, if they decide, we don't have someone at home, for example, who's highly at risk. So we're going to make a choice to send our kid to school and not do things remotely for a variety of reasons. What does a safer experience look like? What are the mitigation strategies that really matter in a classroom environment?
So here's where there's a kind of an old saying that says, what we desperately want is knowledge, but what we desperately need is wisdom. And so we have a relatively, we have limited knowledge in this country regarding kids and schools opening up. What we need is a lot of wisdom, therefore, based upon limited knowledge. But that's been true of this pandemic overall. And so I would refer your listeners to a number of good documents that are out there for guidance for school reopening. The American Academy of Pediatrics, for instance, a good one was the Sick Kids guidance for school reopening coming out of Ontario, which is a marvelous document, I think, that really summarizes a lot of this stuff within these different categories. So. What was the question again?
Trying to think about what are the strategies, the mitigating strategies that matter. Yeah, what works.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. So I think we have to go back to the blocking and tackling that we've talked about before. I think the social distancing, which will be challenging in schools, the use of masks, which I think is there's a lot of very solid evidence, not direct evidence, but what we would call indirect evidence. So you're not going to put 50 people in a room with masks and 50 people in a room without masks and expose them all to SARS-CoV-2 and then say, okay, masks work or they don't. But if that's the kind of proof you're looking for, then we can never say that wearing seatbelts and using airbags has ever been proven. We're not going to do that. It's all based upon, for instance, indirect evidence, and there's lots of it out there. The prior use of masks in healthcare in general, the nature of this virus, which is quite contagious and which any cloth material is going to help some in containing those respiratory secretions. Number three are the studies that show different kinds of masks preventing transmission outward of of these respiratory secretions. And then lastly, to get back to it, the observational studies that show that masks do decrease the incidence of this infection within healthcare organizations, which I think is the main proof that masks work is within healthcare systems themselves. The last two would be hand hygiene. Very important, particularly and probably with the younger children, because they're always going to their nose. It's going to be tough for them to wear masks. They're touching each other and they're touching everything, and so hand hygiene will be particularly important. And then lastly, the environmental cleaning. Although, to be honest, I think the whole issue of fomite transmission, so virus laying on a hard surface that you then pick up secondarily, is probably, well, I think it definitely is less important than the direct transmission between one person and another, primarily large droplet, primarily over a 3 to 6 foot distance. So I think those are the principles. The school systems, I think, in their great wisdom on knowing children and their behavior, are going to apply these things in a very wise manner. And they're going to dive in because we know that, and the pediatricians are speaking loudly on this, that the adverse impacts of school closure on children and youth, and I'm quoting here from that Sick Kids document, significantly outweigh the current benefit of keeping schools closed in order to reduce the risk of COVID-19 in children, youth, school staff, and the community at large. So I think the pediatricians are really speaking, PEDS-ID and general pediatrics are speaking with one voice, that the harm here, what we could call the incalculable collateral damage, is very significant. And it's one of my personal frustrations with how a lot of the COVID-19 stuff has been sort of promoted, is that we're talking about harm only related to the virus. We're not talking enough about the harm of what we've had to do in closing everything down. And so I think a little lesson from the medical side is we commonly say, quoting the famous Hippocrates, as to diseases, make a habit of two things: to help, or at least to do no harm. Well, in this case, you've got both short-term and long-term harm. And I find it interesting that the segment of the population that appears to handle this the best may be the very segment that is going to experience significant harm in the long term. So I think we have to make this calculation. I'm fully in support of schools opening up, using these wisdom principles and relying on the great wisdom of our teachers, our administrators, our school staff, to allow kids not to experience the long-term harm that everybody is afraid of.
Parents and students still have questions and concerns. Lorne Lawrence is a teacher in the Rapid City School District. He's also the father of two children who attend school in the Sturgis School District. Katie Roth teaches in the Sturgis School District. She'll have a class of second graders this year. They both joined us for up close and personal insight into going back into the classroom. Katie, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Maybe I should call you Ms. Roth in case your students are listening, because they're not going to know who I'm talking to otherwise.
Yes, Ms. Roth, whatever you want to call me.
All right, Ms. Roth, second graders coming in, when do you get started? When do you see your students in the classroom for the first time?
September 8th. So we have our start date has been pushed back 2 weeks due to the rally to kind of see how that all plays out.
All right. Tell me a little bit about some of the changes. What's different this year from last year? And then let's talk about what's the same.
So some of the changes are we're going to try to space students out as much as possible. So like in my classroom, kind of the guideline is 3 feet apart for the younger kiddos. And so in my classroom, I have little trapezoid tables that I normally use to seat kids in groups of like six. But at these tables, you can have no more than two if they're going to be 3 feet apart. So our buildings and grounds have been working to build plexiglass barriers for me. So that's one thing that'll be different. In the hallway, we're going to be walking 3 feet apart. So my little line of 7 and 8 year olds is going to be about 70 feet long. So, and then some other changes are We have to split up our cafeteria. So now we're going to use our cafeteria and our gym for lunch. So our PE will have to be outside when it's nice. And then when the weather is not nice enough to be outside, they'll have to do it in our classroom. And other changes kind of depend on what phase our school board decides to start in. We had a school board meeting last night deciding which phase we need to start in, and they weren't able to come to an agreement on that quite yet. So they're going to have another meeting, I believe, on August 31st to decide which phase we're going to start in, and then we'll know for sure some more changes. So,
yeah. What are some of the things that are staying the same? For kids and parents who are excited about going back to school, not everything is different. Some things never change. Talk about that for a minute, if you would.
So some things that are staying the same is, like for me, my goal in teaching is the same. My goal is that all the kids are going to leave my classroom every day knowing that I love them, that I care about them, and I can confidently say that's the same for all teachers at Sturgis Elementary. That will never change. Our main goal of teaching will never change. Other things that aren't changing, they will still have their specials classes, so they'll still get to go to music, computers, PE, all of that will stay the same. They still get to have lunch with their friends. They still get to go to recess. So all of those will stay the same.
Do you get the high fives and the hugs from the teacher that most kids look forward to, or has that changed?
You know, that is going to be the hardest part for me. I am a hugger. I think some of these kids, the biggest thing that they need after 6 months away from school is a hug. So I haven't decided yet if I'm going to hug or do a fist bump. I think I'm going to have a hard time not hugging. I just think it's my nature to give them a squeeze, and so I guess I'm unsure about that.
That is, I have nieces and nephews, and that's one of the things. Their little eyes light up, and they come running at you, and you sit there and you pause for a moment and think, you know, what are the consequences of letting them hug you? What are the consequences of telling them they can't? And it's not an easy thing for people who are, you know, teachers especially, but also aunts and uncles and grandparents, and all kinds of adults who care about kids.
Absolutely.
What are you hearing from parents about some of their apprehensions and some of their excitement and some of their concerns? What sort of questions? Tell me just in general what you're hearing from parents.
Well, I think that a lot of parents are excited to get their kids back to school for the social aspect. They want to see their friends, and it's just good for children to interact with other adults. And so I think that parents are excited for that. You know, the biggest divide with parents right now is some parents say, well, if you don't require masks, I'm going to choose to keep my children home. On the flip side, other parents might say, if you do require masks, I'm going to choose to keep my child at home. So those are kind of the main things that I've heard from parents, and other parents wondering, well, are there repercussions if students don't wear masks when they're required? Just kind of that sort of thing.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about just this idea of teaching students a new skill, because much has been made about whether or not kids can learn how to wear masks or they can learn to walk at a further distance. As a parent who has not worked full-time in a classroom, although I have worked in a school, it seems like there are all kinds of new things that you teach a classroom, from how to use the library to, you know, how to, you know, line up for a drink of water. How do you kind of process that idea of, like, you know, we're going to have to teach them some new skills, but we also understand their developmental abilities?
I don't know if I'm in the majority or minority here. I am fully confident that I can teach my kids how to properly wear a mask. And if I model it, they respect me, and they will learn it. You know, some kids come to school not knowing how to hold a pencil. That's what teachers are for. We show them these things and we model these things. So I honestly think that I would have no problem showing kids how to properly wear a mask. It's not going to happen in the first week. It's not going to happen in the first 2 weeks. But when they know this is what we do to protect each other, I think that they'll be on board. They're so good about that. I think a lot of people are underestimating what the kids can do as far as masks.
We're going to bring a parent into the conversation now. Lawrence is he's also a teacher in the Rapid City School District, but he's the father of two children who attend school in the Sturgis School District. And Lauren, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So we're talking about back to school in Sturgis, and I'm wondering some of the things that your kids are excited about going into the classroom, and then some of their concerns. What are you hearing at home?
Well, the biggest thing right now is they're both going into different schools. My daughter's going from fourth to fifth grade, and the fifth grade is now part of the middle school. And my son's going from eighth to ninth grade, so he's going to the high school. So they're both pretty excited about just the change of buildings.
Yeah.
I think they want to get back and see their friends. I mean, in that sense, that they're really excited for the school year just to – what they think, you know, get back into something more normal. I think they haven't really thought about, you know, all the restrictions, the face masks and stuff. But we've been doing our best to prepare them for that. You know, if they go out in public with us, they're wearing their face masks. We're just reminding them of safety protocol, you know. So we've been trying to model that, teach that to them, you know, before the school year starts, and hopefully it translates into the school year. Just my son's not the biggest fan of school. So, you know, he's has his reservations, but he would have had those reservations anytime. I think, you know, he's just,
it adds another layer to what school represents. Yeah. If you're not all into it and excited, it adds another layer. And then, this. I want to talk to both of you about the summer slide, and in this case, potentially the pandemic slide. And I'll start with you, Ms. Roth. How are you planning to, you know, every kid is going to come back every summer at a different level. Are you anticipating some kind of, you know, catching up from what maybe they missed in first grade when they, went home and started learning remotely?
Yeah, absolutely. So, before our school year even ended this last year, our principal had us communicate with the grade level below us on what skills and what standards were taught from a distance. So say like the first graders coming into second grade next year, we're going to need to work with time and money because that was what was taught from a distance last year. So we have 15 minutes of our day allotted to teaching skills that might have been missed due to distance learning.
Yeah.
So
time and money. Me too.
What's that?
Don't we all need to still work on time and money skills?
For sure, lifelong skill. Yes. And then I do believe I haven't heard anything on this for a few weeks now, but I know at one point we were planning on doing some after school tutoring for some of the kiddos that need some extra intervention, and we have title teachers as well that pull kids and work on some gaps that they have. So I think at our school, we are fully prepared to make up for the lost time that we had.
Lauren, how about with your kids or even your students in the Rapid City School District? How are you preparing your kids to go back in when they might have lost, certain parts of the school year last year? Where do you begin?
We've been addressing that a little bit at a time. We look at some of the things that they were doing at the end of the year. We're just kind of re-familiarizing them with that, hopes that, you know, it sticks. I guess we'll see what the school decides as, you know, what skills that they need to work on again, and we can work with them at that point. You know, I don't want to overwhelm them with, well, here's everything you did last year. You know, we need to go over all this to make sure you didn't forget it. I mean, we don't want to overwhelm them that way. But so whatever the school lets us know that they think they need to strengthen, we will do it. I mean, it's, you know, and I think our kids will mostly be willing to do that, you know. And as a teacher, last year it didn't go very well. I mean, that fourth quarter of the school year was really just kind of loss. As an Algebra 2 teacher, most of my students probably weren't going to take another math class anyway. So, I didn't leave them fully prepared, but at the same time, they don't need more skills for the next class. So, I mean, that was kind of a lucky thing on my part. Sure. I'm teaching a basic skills class for students entering high school this year, something new in the district in Rapid City, and I'm really looking forward to doing that. So, I mean, hopefully that class is built right, I mean, for what we're doing here. I mean, I'm hoping that I can look at what skills we have deficits in and work with that stuff in addition to just getting them ready to step into an Algebra 1 class when they're ready.
SARS-CoV-2 is also spread by people who don't know they are contagious because they have no symptoms. So students, teachers, and other school staff are at risk of transmitting and acquiring the infection. Naturally, this causes anxiety, and that anxiety can lead to other disruptions in the classroom or at home. Charisse LaRue is a licensed psychologist with Black Hills Psychology. Sarah Conradi is also a licensed psychologist with Sanford Health. They joined us to explore the emotional toll. Charisse, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Sarah, thanks for being here as well.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So let's just start with this idea that, you know, as worried as we are about whatever we're worried about, we can't be perfect parents for our kids. So Charisse, let's start with you and dispel a little bit of this myth of perfect parenting as we navigate everything from uncertainty of back to school to our own anxieties about what that looks like.
Well, I think there's even been some research that says that there's good enough parenting. So I think if parents try their best for their child or their children, they're doing a good job. They're going to do okay. I think this is so new to not only parents, but even psychologists and education providers, and it's just a new thing for everyone across the world. So we're just trying to navigate the best we can and problem solve the best we can. And I know there's a lot of anxiety going into this school year, and so I think kind of the biggest thing people can do is just kind of try to stay calm and support each other and be patient and be creative, I guess.
Yeah. Sarah, anything you want to add to that just about creative parenting and just how many we've been through it to a certain extent because we started in spring with this great disruption. Maybe we're more prepared for the fall than we were for that early transition in spring. What do you think, Sarah?
Yeah, I agree with Charisse in that there is such a thing as good enough parenting, and kids are pretty resilient, more resilient than we often give them credit for, and a lot of this is actually more difficult on us adults as we try to navigate our own, you know, home versus career lives, as well as prepare our kids for school and the uncertainty of what the school year is going to look like, but realizing that we're all in the same boat, we're all in this together, I think is helpful in knowing that we're all doing our best with information that we have at the moment, and we'll continue to do that as we face, you know, the unknown that's up to come with the rest of the school year.
All right, so we brace ourselves for the days ahead, and we get ready to work hard and be uncertain at the same time. Let's talk about some basics about what we tell kids and what we don't tell kids. And I'm guessing this is partially developmental and partially like, you know, you got to know your kid a little bit. But are there some broader ideas? And Sarah, we'll start this time with you. Some broad things to keep in mind, like how do I know how much to tell my child about, you know, when they ask questions about, am I going to get sick? Is it dangerous to go back? Is mommy going to get sick? Am I going to die from this? Like, how do you make decisions as a parent to what are you going to tell them and what are you going to withhold because they're not ready to hear it? Sarah?
Yeah, that's a great question. So you're absolutely right. The developmental age of the child is really important, but also at the same age, our children behave differently. So a seventh grader with anxiety versus a seventh grader without may need to have a completely different conversation and preparation as they head back. When you're thinking of younger children, just the basics, the most simple language, and really just following their lead. So not answering questions that you think they may have, but allowing them to ask the questions they have and then responding with the information that we know. And with small children, it's, you know, it's going to be the basics that we've all become very familiar with hand washing and wearing masks and the social distancing, and just explaining to them that they can follow the lead of their teachers at school and their parents at home, and that we will keep them informed if and when things change, so that they don't have to worry about what's to come. Because uncertainty, as difficult as it is for adults, it's also very difficult for kids, and they look to the adults in their lives for guidance. And when we're talking about older kids, really using scientific facts as much as we know. So this somehow has kind of become a divided topic, which as parents, it's good to keep in mind that it doesn't need to be that way for our children, that the more they see kind of a united front of the adults in their lives and an agreement upon, well, we're going to do whatever we know is best in the moment, rather than, you know, sharing any of your viewpoints as far as some of the questionable areas that, you know, there's been some debating. So just giving them the facts and what we know at the time, and then again letting them lead with their questions.
The coronavirus pandemic has necessitated rapid and often extreme institutional changes, and as we've heard, our education system was no exception. As South Dakota school districts across the state report positive COVID-19 cases, we checked in with three superintendents to discuss what they're seeing, what they anticipate will happen next. We'll talk with people from Lemon and Beresford in a moment, but first, Terry Nebelsick. He's superintendent of the Huron School District. Terry, welcome. Thank you for being here.
Good morning, Lori. It's a pleasure to help you.
Tell us where you are at right now with those positive COVID-19 cases. What can you report?
Well, I can share that this is our first week of school, and that so far we have no COVID-19 cases that have been caught from one person to another within the school setting. Each of the ones that we have dealt with in the early parts of this week have been that families by different connections have had it in their home, and then it's been shared with us that there's someone that was a direct contact, or in two cases, students had tested positive. Neither of those students that tested positive had attended a school day yet. And so as far as the notification that we've had a positive tested student or staff member in school, that has not happened yet. What caused a bit of publicity was that we did have a person on the football team that tested positive, and we went through the provisions to make sure that we were handling that correctly. But all of that happened before the first day of school. So far, so good.
Tell me a little bit about how contact tracing is being handled. Is that something that everybody is going through the state for, or that, and notifications are being made? How do you handle the communication?
Thank you. Well, first of all of us work directly with the Department of Health, and they communicate with the person who has tested positive, and then they determine the close contacts, and then each school district has immediate access to that. Superintendent's cell phone number, and then whoever they designate as their number two in case the superintendent can't answer the phone, get that information as soon as possible. What's unique to Huron is because we've had a testing center since we were an early hotspot back in April, is that our testing center has a person from the Department of Health on that, and when we have the information, we move immediately with that information, working with the Operations Task Force. So that by the time the Department of Health calls in the next 24 to 48 hours, we've been able to mitigate without that downtime. And that has worked well for us, and I think it's the reason why we've been able to make sure that things in school were in good shape. The other thing I'd say quickly, Lori, is that we are starting in yellow, which for us means that we're masked all the time, students and staff, with the exception of when they're eating a meal or when they are outside.
For parents or students or staff members who are concerned just about the prevalence in the community, who say, well, you know, we haven't been to the building yet, but we know, that there are positive cases in the community and amongst students, there are presumably asymptomatic cases. What are you saying to sort of reassure them that this is something that you feel confident about back to school?
Well, so far the information from the 164 days that we were not together is that the highest likelihood of catching it comes from social events that are taking place, whether that is weddings, receptions, family reunions, et cetera, and that the data is pretty profound that the likelihood of children that are 10 years old and younger either catching it or giving it to someone is less than 1 in 10 compared to older kids and adults. And so that is good reassurance. And then we have over 3,000 shields set up on desks, as well as everyone masked. And so we think with our social distancing strategies and our mitigation strategies that children are less likely to get it in the school setting than in the social settings that take place outside of the school. Since most social settings have to do with older kids, then there's obviously going to be a propensity for that to happen at the high school level or those that are connected to kids that have been to college and come home, that type of thing.
Superintendent Terry Nebelsick from Huron, thank you so much for being with us, and best of luck on back to school.
Thank you, Lori. I wish you well.
Now we head to Northwest South Dakota to check in with the Lemon School District Superintendent Steve Books. Thanks for being here today.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
What can you tell us about positive COVID-19 cases and back to school? How are they intersecting in Lemon?
Currently, this week was a tough week for us. We have been pretty isolated here over the course of the summer. I think we had a few cases in late summer and then nothing after that. But this week, we have seen four cases of staff members, primarily isolated at our elementary school. So it was decided over the course of the weekend and this week that we have closed our elementary school until the 8th of September.
Give me an idea of what happens next. And specifically, I want to talk about contact tracing and the quantity of testing that you think you might need to bring those students back to school. What are the plans ahead? How are you balancing your decisions and opportunities and obligations?
Well, I'll tell you, we are working closely with Department of Health. We have tracer investigators, I guess we call them, looking at our situation. By closing when we did, we were well within that 14 days. I believe we were more than 14 days when we got our first positive. So moving forward, the desire would be to, when we start back on the 8th, that we would have given that illness time to end for those positive people. And then basically we're just going to keep conversations going with the Department of Health. They've been very helpful in tracing these students that might have been impacted. So
we have seen areas, you know, whether there was an outbreak at Smithfield or in Huron or with nursing homes, where the Department of Health has conducted wider spread testing. Any thoughts about, you know, when you're bringing people back in, is there enough testing going on, in your opinion, to do that safely or to move forward safely?
Well, I do know that one in particular individual was turned away. They weren't tested because they weren't direct contact. They were concerned, obviously, but they were turned away from our clinic and were not going to be tested. So I think our local clinic and the hospital near us is doing everything they can to test appropriately. We're not requiring or asking our staff to do mass testing or sensory testing, as they call it.
Give me an idea. You said you're working closely with the Department of Health, and I'm wondering if you're working with other districts as well. Are you talking to other superintendents? What is that circle of communication been looking like?
Currently, well, let me back up. When I was creating my plan here for Lemon, I had several superintendents within the area, you know, surrounding area that I did communicate with, just asking what they were doing and having some kind of an idea of where to start, because we're all in this unknown right now as to what's happening. So prior to any outbreak that I had several conversations with other soups. But now everybody has their own plan based on what they're experiencing. And I am working more with the Department of Health investigators at this point. Just those conversations that we're having, you know, we're on a first name basis right now in Lemon, but they're helpful in as far as what we do next, and they're great at offering advice and saying, you know, you're doing it, you know, you're doing absolutely everything you need to do right now, so keep doing that. And so I think we're just talking with those experts, if you will, is important. So
yeah. Superintendent Steve Books from Lemon, thank you so much for being here with us today. We appreciate your time.
Thank you, Lori. Have a good day.
Next up, we have Superintendent Brian Field from the Beresford School District. Welcome, Superintendent Field. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with some of the same questions here, and that is, give us an update on positive COVID-19 cases associated with the Beresford School District and back to school. How are those things intersecting in your community?
Sure. Right now, we just put out an update to our parents through email and also through our social media. And right now, we have 4 staff members in our schools that have been diagnosed with COVID-19, and 3 of those have been at our elementary school and then 1 at the middle school, high school. And right now, we have 4 staff members that are in isolation, and then we have 8 staff members and 7 students that are in quarantine at this time. So those are updated numbers as of this morning, August 26th.
All right, and so for listeners, those eight staff in quarantine, those are people who have not tested positive but who are spending time alone to try to wait and see if symptoms appear. Do we understand that correctly?
Right. Those 8 staff members that are in quarantine and 7 students, they would be required to quarantine for 14 days since their last contact with a person who has COVID-19.
Tell me what happens going forward. Changes to school policy, what happens next?
Well, we are struggling right now to have enough substitutes because we've got staff members that have been impacted in our classified workforce as well as our certified teaching workforce, and we only have so many subs to go around in our community for our schools. So we are having a special board meeting tomorrow night, and one of the topics that we're going to discuss tomorrow night is to possibly designate all school employees as critical personnel under the critical infrastructure provisions of federal COVID-19 guidelines, which would potentially allow our personnel who have been exposed to COVID-19 to continue to work as long as they're asymptomatic and they test negative. There are some schools that have adopted similar motions at board meetings. So right now, without that designation, any staff member in our school who has been exposed to anyone testing positive for COVID would have to self-quarantine for 14 days. And that's causing a lot of issues for us. So we're going to discuss that and figure out what we can try to do to have our classrooms and our different classified positions covered here in our district, because we're running out of subs.
Tell me what you're hearing from parents about that plan to sort of bring people in who might, you know, who might be contagious. That they I'm guessing we all know the answer to that.
Yeah. You know, problem we're having now is within our school confines. You know, we're finding this is happening more frequently now. And there's a lot of roles that are very difficult for us to fill right now. And obviously we want to, avoid having healthy staff stay at home because of an exposure. But I certainly understand some parents and her staff could question this, and it might be controversial, but it definitely warrants a board discussion now, because I know our parents want our kids in school. They want their kids to be safe. And, you know, right now we're in, you know, phase two, which we call normal learning with accommodations. The next step for us would be to go to hybrid learning, where half the kids are in school, maybe Monday, Tuesday, the other half are in school, Thursday, Friday, and that's called modified on-campus or hybrid learning. And then obviously the fourth model would be our remote learning that we had to go to last spring. But, you know, we want the perception to be, if our board moves forward with this, they'll discuss it tomorrow night at 5:30 in a special meeting in our high school library. You know, we want our healthy staff here working with our students to provide the best possible education possible. And that's why we're giving consideration to the critical infrastructure workers, some called essential workers. But we know that that is a concern amongst some parents too. So, but we need to visit about it and, you know, do what we can to try to provide the best possible education possible. The questions I'm getting now is, when is too much, and when do you move to hybrid, or when do you move to remote? When is that going to happen? And I don't have that answer yet.
Has the Department of Health offered any large-scale testing for staff? Is this massive testing or widespread testing? We only have about 30 seconds left, but is
sure.
that a potential solution not?
You know, we've heard from the Sentinel program, too. We're not part of that right now, but we have worked with, you know, four different Department of Health contacts that have contacted our district. So they've been very helpful to answer my questions, whether it's through phone or email. So we'll continue to work with them and reach out to them for guidance and support, and continue to communicate and keep our parents and staff updated as well.
Superintendent Brian Field from Beresford, thank you so much for being here with us. We appreciate your time.
All right. Thank you for having us. Appreciate it.
Now, back during spring break of 2020, South Dakota colleges and universities made the urgent pivot to remote learning to prepare for a pending pandemic. A month prior to the start of this school year, we were asking how important it really is for students to get back into the classroom instead of learning remotely. Brian Maher is the executive director of the South Dakota Board of Regents, and he joined us for that big picture conversation. Tell us a little bit about your background, and then we'll talk about how you came into making that transition from K-12 to higher ed.
Sure. Well, you just described my entire career. it was K-12. It was all K-12 until this spring when the executive director position with the Board of Regents came open. I was encouraged to look at it, and when I started that thought process, Lori, the question that was in my mind, me, for the executive director at Board of Regents, with a big question mark at the end of it. Mm-hmm. But after I talked to several people who kind of understood the situation and maybe understood some of my strengths and weaknesses, folks who would tell me what I need to hear and not necessarily what I wanted to hear, I thought, yeah, me, with an exclamation point rather than a question mark at the end of that. So I made the switch from a math and physics teacher, high school principal, a K-12 superintendent, to now the executive director of the Board of Regents.
What were some of those strengths that you were hearing from them that matched with the need in higher ed?
I think that the biggest thing that I heard was my ability to lead, and not necessarily my ability to understand academic affairs or common course offerings or some of those issues that I'm beginning to know now in the position, but rather more of a general approach to leadership and be able to bring people together for a common cause. And as I looked at what I thought, my perception of what the needs were in this position, those were some of the things that matched up. So I thought we can give this a go, and hopefully it's a win-win, a win for me, but also a win for the folks who are in our regental system.
One of the conversations, that I remembered the most with you, and really the most since I began hosting this show, was a time you came into the studio and we sat down after the Parkland High School shooting and talked about some really difficult conversations about feeling safe in school, what we already were doing, what still needed to be done, things that people didn't know we were doing. It's not ever thinking it can't happen here, and some of that behind the scenes work. Now here, so I, when I think of you, I think of someone who is not afraid to have a difficult conversation and who I can ask anything to. Here we are, looking at fall 2020, at COVID-19, and I don't think anybody believes that it can't happen here, that we can't have an outbreak at a South Dakota university or college, that we can't have an outbreak at a school. Talk to me about how you move into this kind of situation and say, you know, we can't deny the reality of what it means to go back to class, and we can't deny the reality of what it means to learn remotely. Where do you begin?
Yeah, well, first of all, I remember that conversation too, and I would tell you that I had somebody ask me as I was leaving the Sioux Falls School District, what were the toughest issues you dealt with as a superintendent? And I identified two. One was the time around that Parkland shooting and the uncertainty in terms of safety in our K-12 institutions. And the other one was an issue they're still dealing with, and that is the reaction to the pandemic. And as I move into this position, that has driven virtually every conversation. There's an overlayment of what's going on with the pandemic. And it now directly to your conversation, how do we address that? How do we address the fears of opening up schools when we still have this public health issue, just everywhere in everything that we do? And I would say there are a couple of things in attempting to answer your question that we feel. Number one, that it's really important that we get kids back to the campus, and number one, but also that we keep them on campus, number two. So there's a whole public health issue there. There's a mental health component to getting folks back to some sense of normalcy, and a whole lot of work has gone into trying to get the kids, not all kids anymore, trying to get the students back in the swing of going to class every day, face-to-face where we can, and making sure that as the Regental system, where the majority of our students are going to be taught from a higher ed perspective in this state, how do we make sure that environment is safe? I can tell you that from the board perspective, that occupies most every conversation at the board level. And in my conversation with the campus presidents, I'm a part of those conversations multiple times a week, that drives almost every conversation they're a part of as well. It is a taxing, time-consuming conversation that is also critical if we can accomplish those two goals of, number one, having students back, and number one, keeping students on campus once we have them back.
Yeah. I think most people know, no secret, that my daughter is a college student. She goes to college out of state, and I know from our personal experience in our household that her school is revamping, not only how they live and how they get their food, but also revamping their education itself and taking some of the brightest minds and this generation, saying, this is your problem to solve too. So engineers are working on engineering solutions, and art, people who are studying in the arts are working on equity in the arts and how to rethink everything from, theater during a pandemic to, playing music during a pandemic. It's fascinating to watch, and it's kind of exciting. And I'm wondering if those same kinds of conversations are happening here in South Dakota, where we say, these students who are coming into, this academic setting, we need them. We need them to be not just getting their, you know, speech credit, but we need them to be helping to solve this really complicated problem because they have to live with it too. What kinds of conversations have you had about how you know, or have you heard from college presidents about how the very curriculum and the way that what they're going to study and how they're going to study is transforming for this incoming class?
Yeah. Well, the first thing I should say, Lori, out of just total transparency is this daughter that you speak of, I know her and have great admiration for her and want to recruit her back into the Regental system. So you tell Jane that it's not too late for her to come back to South Dakota. We want her and need her here. Also tell her I miss her. The thing that I would say is you've just described some of the experiences that I've had while on campus. I've been to each of our Regental institutions, minus Northern, at this point, and I will be there yet this week. So I will have visited every campus. And in every situation, I've been brought into classrooms where the transformations that you're talking about have taken place already in many regards, where you see the PPE in place so that students and staff are as safe as we can possibly make them, where the social distance opportunities are already being planned for. Students are already being talked to for how we can best serve their needs and keep them safe. And I think you're exactly right to include students as part of that conversation and part of the solution just makes the most sense, because we do have great minds on campus. And many of those minds are in our student population. So we'll continue to have them as part of whatever solutions we seek. From a very high level, from a board perspective, I would remind the folks in South Dakota that we actually have a student regent. So when we have this conversation at the regental level, one of the voices around the table is an actual current student in the Regental system. So we take that voice serious, and we'll continue to do so.
This is the conversation that takes up all the oxygen in the room, but there are other issues with higher ed. Do you have goals? Are you hearing other, priorities? Is it are you having conversations about equity and diversity, about retaining those students and filling workforce development? Like, what are some of the, you know, the big issues that if you weren't worried and working relentlessly on the public health issue that are also being worked on here in 2020?
Yeah, great question. So we get so focused on the public health issue, and rightfully so, that some of the other issues are taking a back seat. We have passed in the last legislative session here, Lori, was a bill called Senate Bill 55, and Senate Bill 55 really is requiring the Board of Regents to take a microscope and look at it from a business practices, from an efficiency standpoint, and trying to determine, are we running the best business we can run? It's looking at the issues that you described. It's looking at enrollment trends. It's looking at effective use of tax dollars, and many of the topics that I think you had talked about there. I think as a person new to the position that I'm in, I'm looking at that as a real opportunity for me, but also for our system, and giving us an opportunity to look at all of our business practices and looking at the way we're serving the state of South Dakota from a regental point of view. How are we contributing to the economic development by making sure that we have offerings that our students need to become gainfully employed? Are we exercising our opportunities for research that will help move this state forward to the next great thing? All of those things will be talked about, discovered, and discussed in that Senate Bill 55, which will become a very public topic over the next calendar year. I'll overlay that with our opportunity to redo a strategic plan from the Board of Regents, and I think I think a year from now, many of those topics will come to light, but we'll have conversations about those topics as this year goes along. So the things that you described, equity and diversity, economic development, enrollment trends, all of those topics will be a part of that conversation.
And I'm not asking you to speculate, but I do recall in the previous legislative session back in January, February, March timeframe, talk about consolidation of courses or even universities. And my question to you is everything on the table as you look at a new strategic plan? How do you approach some of those big picture conversations and be open to all kinds of ideas, or are there parameters that are already set that you're working within a structure of?
No, I think everything's on the table. I don't want to go in there thinking that that I or we are going to take some sort of draconian approach to the Regental system and really look to restructure. I don't know that that's. That was not a directive when I was hired, and that's certainly not something that's top of mind for me. But I would say we're looking at, you know, duplication, for example. Are we offering what we need to offer, where we need to offer it from a program perspective? Do we have too many programs that are duplicating costs, those sorts of things? Are we meeting the needs of the workforce in South Dakota? For example, I had somebody talking to me about the nursing programs, and we seem to have several nursing programs, but you know, overlay that with the fact that we also still have a need for nurses in this state. So there's a supply and demand component to that. So from the perspective of, I think you called it consolidation, Lori, it might be more looking at consolidation of services rather than, I don't want to put a fear in anybody's mind that we're looking at a consolidation of campuses, but certainly people, program, services, we'll look at all of those things as we go through this coming year.
It's important that everyone in the school community take steps to reduce transmission, particularly for those at high risk, while balancing the need to maintain a strong education system that effectively supports staff, students, and communities. It's also important that we treat one another with compassion as well as accountability. We work from the assumption that everyone involved here has the best interest of children at heart, even if we don't always agree on how to keep the virus away from schools. Health and education are both extremely heartfelt values. If one parent wants their kid to stay home, that doesn't mean they think a quality education is somehow frivolous or optional. If another parent wants their kids engaged in face-to-face learning, that doesn't mean they don't care about the health of teachers. When we choose to see positive intent in a really difficult situation, our relationships within our communities center on open communication and stronger bonds of trust. But most importantly, we show our children, teenagers, and young adults that we have their best interest at heart, that we too are fallible, occasionally confused, angry, frightened. We show them that we are all trying our best and acting out of informed and thoughtful determination and love. Perhaps that's the most important lesson of Back to School 2020. In the Moment podcasts are produced by Josh Heyer. I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.